Hey everybody, Dr. Skinner with you. I am excited to be able to spend this time with you today. We're going to be talking about self-compassion as a part of the healing process, and it's always good to be with you. I want to start off with why self-compassion is so critical, and we're going to talk about some of the barriers. All right, there we go. Can you guys see my screen now? If you can, please put your thumb up. Okay. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about how to incorporate self-compassion into your healing. And my primary focus is there's three parts. I'm going to talk about the barriers to self-compassion. And then I'm going to talk about why self-compassion is critical to your healing. And then I'm going to close off by talking about five strategies to increase your self-compassion. But one of the things that I'd like to share is something that came from my research. And as I've been doing research on the healing and the recovery process, one of the things that has consistently come up is what we call a criteria D of post-traumatic stress. PTSD symptoms, threat to life is criteria A. Reliving it is criterion B, reliving the event or the events, and your mind replays them, so triggers would be there. Criteria C is avoidance, avoiding people, places, or situations that remind you of what happened. And then criteria D is what we call the negative mood and cognitions. And the more I began looking at criteria D, the more I began to see, I started seeing, look, there is a lot of individuals who are feeling overwhelmed by their negative self-talk. And now many people say, I know it wasn't my fault what my partner did. And yet what my research is showing is it is actually way more than people realize. So I'm going to share some of that. And let me just start off by talking about that is a core barrier. And the reason why I call it is a core barrier to developing self-compassion is because when you're stuck in the shame of feeling inadequate, feeling unloved, it's harder to have self-compassion because those are not compatible. And yet, if we don't have self-compassion, it's my belief that we're much less likely to heal. And so I want to talk about this concept of the shame of betrayal. And we typically think about shame in the betraying partner, but not as much in the betrayed partner. And yet in my research, the more I started gathering research data on criteria D, which is negative mood and cognition, I started seeing shame played over and over again in the betrayed partner. And so I want to talk a little bit about that because in my research, and I'll show you some of the research, this is just one of those examples. How often do you feel like your partner acts out because you're not good enough? Now, you can see never is a little over 10%, which would mean over 85% of individuals, sometimes about half the time, more often than not, or always, are feeling like they're not good enough. And think about it in this context, over what would be 30% said always, I feel like I'm not good enough but because of my partner's behavior. And so you begin to see this internalized, I'm not good enough. As the more I saw that in the research, I began to realize we have to start addressing this in the healing process to help our clients get through the betrayal trauma. Because once you have a belief, I'm not good enough, how does that influence how you interact with other people, maybe even in your own parenting, or maybe at work? If you begin to question, I'm not good enough, am I good enough for anybody? And that's one of the things that I saw in looking at the research, it was starting to manifest itself quite frequently. So the next one is, I often hear people say, it's not my fault, it's not my fault what they did. And yet my research would suggest that about 83 to 84% of individuals say sometimes or more, they think it's their fault. If I would have done X, Y, Z, or if I would have been more of this, more attentive, more caring, more, then this wouldn't have happened. And so you begin to see even this internalization is it's my fault. I did something, whatever it is, and that's why they acted out. Now that internalization, right? I'm not good enough. It's my fault. You can start to see this shame of there is something wrong with me. I'm not enough. I'm not lovable. And again, those types of statements are exactly the opposite of what we're looking for with self-compassion. So the antidote that I'm going to be talking about is going to be self-compassion. But we need to understand how pervasive these negative core beliefs actually are. So I'm going to share with you a couple of other findings that I have. How often do you feel ashamed because of your partner's sexual behaviors? And here, over 50% said they always feel ashamed because of what their partner did. So other people are going to be looking at me. I wasn't enough to keep my partner, whatever it is. And so you begin to see how pervasive this really is. All right. So I'm hoping that this will pull up and we'll be able to see it this way, a little bit, maybe a little bit bigger. All right, so then we go to the next question. And this is a fundamental question. I feel stupid for not discovering my partner's behaviors earlier than I did. And you can see 60%, how did I miss it? But when you say never, you can see less than 5% haven't ever felt that way. But sometimes, all the way up to always, well over 95% somehow feel stupid. I didn't figure it out. Now, these are over 1,000 people, thousands of people who've answered these questions and are answering this way. So this is a big sample, and you can see, I feel stupid. I feel like I'm not good enough. I feel ashamed by my partner's behaviors. And you can start to see the shame and these negative beliefs settling in. And that, in my opinion, is where the trauma gets trapped, because it's, I'm not enough and there's nothing I can do. I feel stupid, I'm not enough. And that's where the trauma gets trapped, in these beliefs of not being enough, not being lovable, feeling stupid. And then I had one other, since discovering your partner's behaviors, how often do you feel unlovable? And again, this is just, to me, this is significant. Always 30%, more often than not, 27, 28%. And you start to see these, and we're again, over 90%, I feel unlovable sometimes or more. I'm not lovable. And to me, that's the damage of betrayal trauma, is these beliefs that begin to settle into what I would refer to as a virus being downloaded into the system. I'm not enough. I'm not lovable. And that, to me, is the virus that we need to treat in order for us to transition into a healing place. So I want to talk about why it's so critical, and why self-compassion is so critical to your healing. Because if we don't have self-compassion, then we're going to be stuck in that shame that we just talked about. And that's based upon my research. We have to find the antidote to those negative core beliefs. And I believe that the answer comes in self-compassion. And if we define self-compassion, obviously self is with me, the calm is with. So with self, the passion is actually suffering. So if we look and break down the word compassion, it means with suffering. So I'm with my own suffering. And I believe that is a critical part of the healing process. There's a quote here by Christopher Germer. He said, first, we need to recognize that we deserve to feel better. When we feel really bad, most of us engage in self-punishment rather than self-compassion. We heap self-criticism. This wouldn't have happened if I weren't so stupid, upon ourselves. And so Christopher Germer is saying here, what happens if instead of self-punishment, I'm stupid, I'm not enough, I'm unlovable, that in that self-criticism, what if it was self-compassion? So what we really need to engage in is this self-compassion. And self-compassion, then, as long as your mind is being self-critical, it can't show loving kindness towards itself. It's hard to heal when you're on your own. You're your own worst critic. It's hard to heal when you are your own worst critic, because you don't need other people. You don't need your betraying partner. You don't need them. You're doing it all by yourself once you've inherited that core belief. So healing, then, in my belief, healing comes when we develop this self-compassion and we, so to speak, take out that virus. I'm not enough. I'm not lovable. I'm stupid. And we apply self-compassion. Healing occurs when you know you are enough, when you know that you matter and that you are lovable. That's the part where you begin to accelerate into your healing, which is why we practice loving kindness meditations, which is why we approach the healing from this channel. It's not just removing the negative core beliefs of not being enough, but it's implementing self-compassion that then accelerates the healing process. I am enough, I do matter, and I am lovable. All right, so I want to talk about five strategies to help you increase your self-compassion. And I'll go through each of these strategies for a couple minutes. But first of all, I want to say that if you will practice these strategies, you will begin to develop more compassion for self. And Christopher Neff, in her book, Self-Compassion, she talks about how as we have self-compassion, we're more likely to have compassion for others. And so here are five strategies that you can implement to help you increase your self-compassion. First of all, you need to pay attention to your self-talk. I gave you some examples from my research: stupid, unlovable, ashamed, not good enough. So we want to pay attention to how often those thoughts are coming into our mental pathways or our mental path. How often am I seeing or hearing or feeling I'm not enough, I'm unlovable, I don't matter? How often are they coming in? Because if you can pay attention to your self-talk, you're going to begin this process of increased awareness. And right now, in the first step, I just want you to increase your awareness. How often am I being critical? Then what we want to do is we want to listen to what your body is feeling or the body sensations when you are being that kind of negative. What does it feel like thinking to yourself, you're stupid, or feeling unlovable? What does your body feel in that mindset? Now, again, one of the core things that we do know is that trauma is trapped in the body. The body, as Bessel van der Kolk says, the body keeps the score. It stores inside of it the trapped trauma. And so learning to listen to the way that it influences your body is a really important part of the healing process. The body is what teaches you where the trauma is. It might be in your neck, it might be in your stomach, it might be, again, wherever it is. We know that the body keeps that trauma stored inside of it. So if I asked you, where do those negative thoughts or emotions, where are they stored? Oh, it's in my stomach, or it's in my throat or my chest. It's up here in my prefrontal cortex, my head. And so we want to identify that. Now, that by itself is an awareness. And then we can practice things through step number three, which is a mindful awareness. It's literally just being mindful of, oh, I see that. I'm feeling that in my chest. I'm feeling that tightness, that tension. Oh, I'm feeling it in my throat or my head. And now I'm just attuning to it. And I might practice a breathing exercise, even a compassionate or a loving kindness meditation for self. May I find peace. May I find healing. May I find my calm. And so you can actually practice a loving kindness meditation. If you want some examples of that, Tara Brach, B-R-A-C-H. She has a wonderful website with many resources on mindfulness and loving kindness meditations. So the mindful awareness is bringing it into your awareness, right? So we're paying attention to our self-talk. We're identifying it in our body. We're being mindful and gathering this awareness of where we feel it, what's happening to our body. And then we're going to practice a loving kindness meditation. And we're going to do that because we're intentionally trying to override or overwrite the negative core beliefs, unlovable, stupid. Now, many times that's a starting point, but in my professional experience, we need to take it a step further. And I wanted to now talk about step number five, which is processing the negative self-talk. If we're going to heal from trauma, we have to practice changing the traumatic memories or experiences in a way that we can reprocess them completely in a different way. Let me give you an example of that. So when I was younger, and I wrote about this in my book, I shared it in my TED Talk, The Other Side of Infidelity, but I shared a story where my parents met in an intersection. I was in the back of my mom's car, my older brother in the front seat, my dad and another woman were in his truck, and we came to a four-way stop, and my parents, my mom saw that my dad was with another woman. My mom and dad got out of the car in the intersection and talked for a little bit. Now, you can do that where I grew up in southeastern Idaho because it's not a very busy street. They got out of the car, and my mom came back crying. Instead of finishing our trip into town that day, my mom drove us to my grandma and grandpa Skinner's. We didn't talk about that experience for 35 years. Now, that little boy in me had that specific memory related to my parents' divorce. And when I was doing some, I was being trained to do become a certified sex addiction therapist, and then being trained to do EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, I chose to do that specific memory when I was being trained to do EMDR. What occurred is that little boy got out of the car while I was doing the eye movement and processed that specific memory, which was that mom and dad getting out of the car, mom crying. The belief was, I'm not important. I don't matter. And when the little boy got out of the car, he literally, when you do something like EMDR, you're processing what, in your mind, what could, would have happened if you could have had a voice. That little boy that day got out of the car. I don't know how, because it was a two-door car, but he did get out. He went to the middle of that intersection, turned to his dad, and was extremely angry. Extremely angry. Yelling at his dad, "What are you doing? You are destroying my family." Now, that boy didn't have that opportunity at age 7 or 8 to do that. But 35 years later, in my 40s, I did have that experience. Here, I reprocessed that experience, that specific belief being not important, not mattering. Because if I mattered, my dad would not do what he's doing. And that processing, reprocessing it, took away the disturbance, took away the painful memory. That little boy had the voice. He was given the voice in that experience of what he needed to do. In that situation, it was an anger, a deeper anger than I'd ever felt. And literally, I was enraged. But after a few more bilateral stimulations, that belief I didn't matter, I saw my grandparents, my grandma making me clothes, sewing me clothes. I saw the love of my aunts and uncles, my mom. I saw my dad at my baseball games. I saw my dad doing other things. And I realized I do matter and I am important. Now, that's my personal story with processing negative self-talk. I didn't matter. But that was a buried memory that came up from my childhood when I was doing some of my own work. Now, that then shifts. What happens when I recognize I am important, I am enough, I do matter, I am lovable? Then those loving kindness meditations have more power. I know the truth. The mindfulness has more meaning because I'm able to sit there and be with myself in that experience, realizing that negative belief, that's just not true. And I knew it wasn't true. I had reprocessed it. So what was once a disturbing memory no longer has power. It's not as disturbing. In fact, it went from a 6 of disturbance to that little boy being able to speak his truth, to the point where it, in terms of levels of disturbance, I can honestly say it's a 0. I no longer feel disturbed by that specific memory. Subsequently, my father apologized to my mother. He apologized to me. He apologized to my siblings. That, for me, was another step in the healing process. So as we talk about self-compassion, it's easier to have self-compassion when I work through my negative core beliefs. So if we are going to help you heal and help you develop literally a self-compassion, we need to recognize that there may be experiences that we need to process through. We are stuck. For me, it was that little boy in that painful memory, being able to reprocess it with a traumatic intervention or intervention that helps us deal with traumas. Now, that's just my personal experience. Some of you may have already had an experience with EMDR, but that's the concept that I apply to with the trauma memories with my clients. Now, let me say something before I go on here. That's just one approach. It's one that I found to be effective. I also have found that bringing key figures into those difficult memories, maybe it was a loving grandparent, maybe it was a loving friend who helps in those difficult memories, I have found that is also effective. As you apply these principles, as you practice them, what begins to happen is you feel more confident, you feel more self-belief. I am lovable and I am enough. All right, I want to just say thank you for spending this time with me. These are some of the core strategies that I would talk or share with you today. It looks like there's some questions in the chat. Looks like we've got some links there. Great. Okay, any final questions? Angie, you have a question?
Yeah, on average, do you happen to know how much EMDR sessions seem to start helping the betrayed partner start healing?
I think it depends on a couple of variables. I think one of them actually has to do with the betraying spouse and whether we're working on this relationship. If we're not working on the relationship, I think it may actually, it can be accelerated because the core belief is what we're still after. But if I'm still in the relationship, say my partner's still acting out, not taking accountability, then I may not be able to work through that specific memory or experience, but I may need to bring in a loving figure, a parent, a grandparent, somebody who is nurturing to me into that memory to help me reprocess what I came to believe about myself. And I've done that with clients whose spouse can't be there, but it's, say, a grandparent, a nurturing person can be there. And I found that can be effective within one or two or even three EMDR sessions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thanks for asking your question, by the way, and thanks for being with us. All right, everybody, thank you so much for spending this time with us today. It's always good to be with you. May you guys be blessed, and I appreciate you taking time to be with us on our Bloom Live.